anecdotal, but I will try to get a hold of that. It's a great question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kaler.
Thank you, Representative Dooling. I'd love to see it myself as well, and I doubt we can track it down tonight, but, or this afternoon, whenever the, I can't remember when we're meeting in joint committee, but different teams. But I think it would be helpful for us to just know, sort of, when granted that was almost a decade ago, but I'm also just really curious as we do our reports in the, as a first termer, looking at all these reports coming through that are required and how often we actually catalog the successes and challenges and opportunities that come back to us through these reports. So,
thank you for that.
Any other questions? I do have a question, Representative Liebling and Ms. Mark. I thought I heard Representative Liebling, you state that the average is 1,000 or 1,200 or something like that. And Ms. Martin stated that they give no more than 300. So my question for Ms. Martin is that that's just a policy of yours in Olmsted County, you give no more than 300. And secondarily, did I hear you say that you have 2,500 total to give away?
This year,
okay.
That's why we limit our individual grants to no more than 300. As a stipulation to receive the grant funding, to establish guidelines for how we sub-grant out the funds. And I think that Representative Liebling was referring to the amounts of the grants, and in our case, 2,500 this year, 5,000 in previous years, because we are the grant recipient, but then we sub-grant out to crime victims who are required to give us receipts and provide evidence of how it's used, or we pay providers directly.
And Ms. Martin, how, in past years when it was 5,000, how quickly was that exhausted? Were you able to stretch that throughout the entire year?
We were able to stretch that throughout the entire year, generally speaking. It also is available to other counties so that we wouldn't carry over any excess. Another county would call us and say, do you have some funds available? And then we are required to make that available to other counties that who had depleted their funds.
Okay. Thank you. Were there any other questions for Representative Liebling or Ms. Martin? Seeing none, then, Representative Kaelin renews his motion to see House File 414 be passed and referred to public safety policy. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion passes. Bill will be re-referred. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Next bill we'll have up, I see Representative Simon in here. Why don't we go with yours? Never the chair.
Mr. Chair, if the committee gives you static, is that what you're giving us back?
No, I'm giving you static, Representative Kaelin. Okay. Thank you, Representative Simon. The motion is the same. All right. The motion will be the same on all these bills. So, Representative Simon, could I have a motion from someone to move House File 1841 and to be passed and re-referred to public safety policy? Okay, your bill is before us. Representative Simon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. Will this bill be heard then, assuming hopefully that it comes out of this subcommittee, will be heard this afternoon in the Joint Committee?
I don't have a crystal ball, Representative Simon, but I anticipate, and I was told the bills that we re-refer to that committee will be heard in the Joint Committee this afternoon. Laid over for possible inclusion, so hope that this is your opportunity to be heard on it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know you have a full plate today. House File 1841, simply put, would allow victims of domestic abuse to terminate their leases in certain circumstances. And I think we can all picture circumstances where this just makes common sense. If someone, as this bill spells out, is a victim of domestic abuse and has a piece of paper from a court Okay, it's not just someone who subjectively believes that they're the victim of domestic abuse, but someone who has an order for protection or a no-contact order. So something from a court saying that they're in danger, that they can get out of their residential lease. That's basically the bill. There are some other bells and whistles that others can describe, but that really is the bill. Now, even under those circumstances, under this bill, because we do want to be sensitive to the landlords, they would still have to, the victim would still have to pay, of course, be caught up on all past rent. This doesn't absolve them from paying any past rent, and they have to pay an extra month's rent. So they can pull out of the residential lease, but they still have to pay 1 month's extra rent in addition to any back rent, and then in addition to any non-refundable damage deposit. So the only thing that changes is that they can get out of their residential lease. They've got to wave a piece of paper from a court that says that they're in trouble and that they're possibly in harm's way. I do want to say, before I turn it over to the testifiers, I do want to thank the multi-housing people. I think Mr. Horner is here today. I want to thank him in particular. It would have been very easy for him and for them to react reflexively against a proposal like this, but to his credit and to his organization's credit, he's been willing to work with us all along the way to try to find an accommodation. I think we're very, very close to global peace on this issue. It may take another committee stop, but I really want to thank him for his accommodation and his reasonableness. I think that's safe to say. He's been a real partner in this. So I'd like to, and he can speak for himself, of course, today, but I'd like to introduce, or she can introduce herself, Melinda Hugdahl, to say more.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Simon. Ms. Hugdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Melinda Hugdahl from the Legal Services Advocacy Project in St. Paul. And I want to thank Representative Simon for his work with us on this bill as well. This is a bill about safety. It's going to protect victims of domestic violence, their children, and other tenants. As Representative Simon has laid out for you already, the bill permits a victim of domestic violence to terminate a lease early if and only if they provide the notice to the landlord that they state that they're a victim of domestic violence, that they have an imminent fear of continuing abuse, and they also have to notify the landlord of the date that they intend to vacate the property. The victim also has to give the landlord a copy of an order for protection or a no-contact order, and so that the landlord has all of that information provided to them. They also must pay a next month's rent, which is due and payable as the date they vacate under the tenancy. Several other states have adopted similar legislation, including Illinois, Colorado, Texas, North Carolina, and the District of Columbia. Under current law, when clients come to our offices for help, there is often no good advice that we can give them. The client's left with two awful choices: leave the premises and face a judgment for unpaid rent or double rent, which many of our clients cannot afford, or remain in the premises and stay in a dangerous, often life-threatening situation. The bill provides a process so that tenants can be advised of a uniform process that will balance the safety of the victim, their children, and other tenants, and the position of the landlord. The process will be uniform, which is not always the case under current law. We've had extensive meetings and negotiations with the Multi-Housing Association, and I thank them also for being part of this conversation. And we have accommodated many, many of their concerns in our discussions and conversations. It's very important to underscore that this law does not diminish the importance of orders for protection and no-contact orders. In fact, it enhances the importance because they have to obtain one to take advantage of the provisions of this law. However, the bill also helps prevent the situation that leads to the violation of the order, the intervening act that happens that results in the police call coming back. That's what we're trying to prevent. This bill is a positive step forward, and in our opinion, for both victims and landlords. It provides a consistent process to protect safety of the victims, their children, and the other tenants. In addition, landlords retain all rights under existing law if a victim does not comply with the requirements of the bill to legally terminate the lease early. Mr. Chair, would you like me to briefly walk through the subdivisions of the bill so members kind of see what they are, or is it kind of, I think the overview has probably given the high points of it. There are provisions included for multiple tenants, and things like that, so that it's clear if there are additional people on the lease, including the perpetrator, they remain on the hook for any damages or continuation of the rent.
I think, Ms. Hudgel, if you could briefly walk through it, that would be helpful.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Subdivision 1 really just lays out the requirements of what must be in the notice given to the landlord. It, again, as we've indicated, is a fear of imminent abuse, continuing abuse, and a copy of an order. Subdivision 2 deals with confidentiality of information. If a victim gives a landlord a statement plus a copy of an order, that won't appear on shared databases and things like that. Obviously, the landlord can use those documents in a court proceeding if they need to, if their actions about unpaid rent or they don't believe they met the requirements of the law. But we just wanted some clarity, and this matches some federal provisions about use of information by landlords. Subdivision 3 really talks about the liability that they must pay the next month's lease, and if they do that, they are resolved from liability on future lease amounts. Talks about termination of the tenancy, that it'll be a date certain so people will know. Subdivision 4 talks about multiple tenants. Again, if there are other tenants in the apartment, they remain liable under the lease that they signed. Subdivision 5 is a waiver prohibition so that landlords cannot ask tenants to waive their rights under this when they sign the lease agreements. And Subdivision 6 is merely a cross-reference so everyone knows what domestic abuse means, and we're cross-referencing to Chapter 518B.
Okay. Were there any questions to the committee from Ms. Hudgel? Okay, I have a question, Ms. Hudgel. If you have a victim who is concerned and she doesn't live with the aggressor, but she's concerned that he knows where she lives, and so she states she's in imminent fear of harm because of domestic abuse, because he can come over anytime and she wants to move someplace anonymous. Does she qualify under this for that as well?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, she would qualify. So it's whether the perpetrator is residing in the apartment or not residing in the apartment. They have to show the imminent fear of abuse and a copy of the order. So it would cover both situations.
Okay, then what if there's a landlord that owns a duplex and he lets his girlfriend move in downstairs and he assaults her? She wants to move out, but he's the landlord. Well, she does move out, but he's the landlord. Does she seriously have to give all this stuff to him, even though he's the aggressor?
Mr. Chair and members, my first reaction would be that she would. I suppose if there was that particular situation happening and she did leave without giving the notice, the landlord would retain their rights to talk about the unpaid lease termination, and I suppose a court could look at the equities of the situation in that particular instance, but they would need to comply with the requirements of the law. They could send it by mail also. They don't have to personally deliver it.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Simon or Ms. Hudgel?
I do, Mr. Chairman. There are some other people here who would like to testify very briefly on the bill. Yes.
Be in support of the bill?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you have them come up?
Good morning. My name is Larry McDonough. I am an attorney with the Minneapolis Legal Aid Society. I'm also a resident of Representative Kamer's district. I'm here to speak in support of the bill. I have a couple of colleagues here from Legal Aid as well, from Legal Aid in St. Paul and in St. Cloud. I'm also a former landlord. We see a few of these cases on a monthly basis, advising tenants of their options, and as Ms. Hudgel said, the options aren't good at this point. From my vantage point, we've negotiated cases with several landlords who have done essentially what the law says. I'm going to let the tenant out, but give me a month's rent so I can re-rent it. But we've had other landlords that say, it's not my problem. I see this essentially as a way to try to alleviate an imbalance in the law. Right now, I think the landlord could file an eviction case for breach of lease if there's violence that occurred in an apartment from an abuser to a victim. So landlord has the option to say, I want to end the lease now. But right now, the tenant doesn't have the option to do the same thing. And so this is essentially creates some options for the tenant that are not unlike the options for the landlord right now. So we hope that you'll pass this, and this will be a good move forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. You have another testifier as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr.
Simon?
Briefly, my name is Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Caluzzi, and I'm an attorney with Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, Smurls, and I'm also a representative of Paymar's district where I live. So it's always good to throw that out. Anyway, I'm a frontline legal aid worker at Smurls, and I deal directly with the clients in these cases, and very frequently, if the fear that people face when even when they have an order for protection when the abuser has come into their apartment before, it's just amazing. And then I have to tell people, well, you might be liable under the lease, you might lose your Section 8, which is grounds for losing your Section 8 if you book on a lease, but you got to do what's going to keep you safe. And many times the only way people can safe or feel safe is just to get out of that situation. And many landlords do cooperate, but probably an equal number say, again, I just called one last week and he said, it's not my problem. And that's just sad. It's just very sad. And so I think it's a fair bill. It gives the landlord rent while he's going to be rented. And I think it pretty much it works out for both sides. Thank you.
And we do have one more testifier.
Yes, thanks for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. One more, and I think this is particularly an important one. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Lorelei Narvalis, and I'm here today to testify on House File 1841, which would allow victims of domestic abuse to break their lease where there's a situation of domestic abuse. I would like to share my own story to show how this bill would provide safety for Minnesota's battered women and children and how it could have protected me. When I was 18 years old, my son and I moved in with my abuser. I had known him since we were in high school, and I felt as though I really knew him. I was wrong. By the time we were together, he became increasingly abusive and assaulted me on several occasions. The incident that is in direct relation to this bill is one that still haunts me 12 years later. One night, my boyfriend came home from work and started to yell and scream at me. He punched me several times in the face. He broke my nose. He blackened both my eyes to the point that I was completely unable to open them. I was bleeding all over my face, and the pain was excruciating. I was in fear for my 2-year-old son, who I had to watch the abuse. My little boy was screaming and crying. I grabbed my son and ran from the apartment for help. I pounded on all the doors of my neighbors, but no one in my building would open the door. So I ran to the nearest gas station. My boyfriend got in his car and started to follow me. He was screaming out the window, "If you tell anybody, I will kill you and your son." I believed him. After the beating he gave me, I could not afford not to believe him. The police were called to the gas station. The officer told me to go into the emergency room and be treated for my injuries. At the emergency room, I found out I had a broken nose and a fractured eye socket, along with severe swelling and facial bruises. My eyes were swollen shut. I still have permanent damage to my eye socket and my nose. When I returned the next day to the apartment with a police escort and my mother, I found that my boyfriend had come back again for more. He had ransacked my entire apartment. My curtains had been slashed with a knife. My television and glass cocktail had been broken with a baseball bat. My floor was full of glass. My son's rocking chair had been ripped apart, and all my clothes had been torn. I had returned to nothing. I was terrified. I felt like I had no hope. I just lost everything. The next day, I met with the apartment management company to see if I could be released from my lease so my son and I could go to a safe location. The property manager sympathized with me and stated that clearly I had been a victim of domestic abuse and that they wished that there was something they could do to help out, but due to their policies and procedures, their hands were tied. And I would be responsible for not only the remainder of the lease, but also over $2,000 in property damage. Because of my injuries, I was unable to work for a month. My son and I had no safe place to live, and I had no money from being unable to work. I had to try and find a place to stay. I talked to my mother. She said she wasn't sure she could protect me and my son. I finally got a friend to take us in. I could not afford paying two rents plus damages, so I had to stay with my friend for a month. I did get an order for protection while I tried to pay the bills, but unfortunately, it did not protect me from being victimized by him. Please pass this bill. It would have helped me when I went to Longwood to ask for help. If this would have been a law, it would have been able to take me and my son to a safe, stable place to live. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Evans.
I think we have, Mr. Chair, just one more person who wants to weigh in.
If we could have that person weigh in very briefly.
Yeah, thank you.
And then we'll go to Mr. Horner.
It is Mr.
Horner. Okay. is there, Mr. Horner, are you the only one who's going to be testifying in opposition, or is there anyone else you know of?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're not in opposition.
Oh, okay.
I'm just, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just here to thank the author very much and Legal Aid. We do have an agreement. It's a work in process. Okay. We're continuing to work, but nevertheless, we have an agreement on the essence of the concept. We support the concept. We appreciate the work that's been done, and I'm just here to say that that a lot of good work is being done, and we fully anticipate getting a finished product soon. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. Okay. Are there any questions members had for the testifiers or Representative Simon? Hearing none, then, and I would say, Representative Simon, I have a note from the committee administrator for public safety. Not all of these bills will be reheard in the joint hearing today. However, I will discuss with the committee administrator at the time what we're going to do. I'll be on top of it. So
thanks
with that, there being nothing else to be said, who moved this? Representative Johnson moved this. Renews his motion to pass House File 1841 and have it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Simon. Representative Paymar, can you speak to 1354? I believe, Representative Paymar, it's to pass and to be re-referred to Representative Mullery's committee.
Okay.
Public Safety, Civil Justice.
That's the motion. Okay.
Great, yes. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 1354 essentially prohibits law enforcement agencies or prosecutors to ask or require that a complainant of a criminal sexual conduct offense submit to a polygraph examination as part of or a condition to proceeding with an investigation, charging, or prosecuting of the offense. There's two reasons why we're bringing this bill before the committee and the legislature this year. Is one, it's the impact of on crime victims. Requiring rape victims to submit to a polygraph testing unfairly singles them out and treats them differently than other crime victims. And also the requesting or requiring a polygraph may also discourage victims from reporting the crime, which is already significantly underreported. The second reason is a more practical financial reason. In the 2005 reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, there was a provision that was put into the act that said that states that refuse, that require victims of sexual offenses to undergo a polygraph examination would not be eligible for their stock grants. And for those of you who don't know what stock grants are, they're grants to local law enforcement agencies and prosecutors. And so the state would is the recipient of $2 million of those grant funds. So in Washington, when they created VAWA, they determined that it was inappropriate to require victims to go through polygraph testing. I have two witnesses who would like to testify, Mr. Chair. And
Ms. Long?
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Karen Long again. I'm with the Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And we also have present today Roger Peterson, who is the police chief in Rochester, Minnesota. I will say just briefly that we became aware of the provision in the Violence Against Women Act requiring this from states, and we asked the Department of Public Safety, who we appreciate, did take this measure on and drafted it. And I'll just mention that sometimes people ask me, does this really happen? Are victims of, does somebody who comes forward with a sexual assault actually get asked to take a polygraph? And the answer to that is yes. It's probably not as common as it used to be, but with just the informal contacts that we have around the state, I was able to locate at least 5 different counties where this has happened in the last couple of years. So it does happen from time to time in Minnesota, and of course we need to pass it in order to get the VAWA funding. So I'll defer to Chief.
Thank you. And Ms. Long, well, I guess I do have a question before Chief Peterson comes up. What are the counties that you were able to determine that this has happened in the past few years?
I can tell you from memory that it's a mix of rural and metro. I didn't write down the counties to be able to say specifically right here, but I could certainly get that information to you. But it does come from both city and rural areas.
Okay. I'd be interested in getting that information later. And Chief Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm Chief Peterson from the City of Rochester, Police Chief. I've been in law enforcement for close to 26 years now, almost 9 years of that spent as Police Chief. More importantly, 15 years was spent as an investigator, investigative supervisor, specifically in violent crime. I tell you that so you know that some public perception out there that police chiefs don't always know how the work gets done. At least what we're talking about here, I know how the work gets done here. I testify and qualify as an expert in crime scene assessment and analysis, interview and interrogation, and investigative techniques. Our department, and certainly in my past experience, has dealt with the issue of sexual assault on a very large scale. And as was noted by the representative, this is a crime that's tremendously underreported. Department of Justice estimates that as much as 85% of sexual assault is not reported to police. We don't need more barriers to that process. Number one reason they're not reported, I don't think I'm going to be believed. And we don't need to hit them at the door with a polygraph test. You prove it before we investigate. It's just not good business. But I think that probably most people understand, and what the federal rationale is, and certainly our rationale from the standpoint of not making that process more intimidating, more cumbersome than it already is. But there is an issue out there that I think you're asked to address, and specifically what I was asked to address, was that there is language in the proposed bill that says cannot ask or require. And I think you've heard some debate in regard to, well, wouldn't it be okay if we just asked? We can't require it of a sexual assault victim, but wouldn't it be all right just to ask? And if they were willing to do that, wouldn't that be okay? Well, the reality is the language regarding requiring somebody to take a polygraph, we can't require somebody to give a statement. We can't require somebody to report to begin with. The only word that makes this bill viable, the only impact they can have is ask. If we ask, we have all of the negative impact associated with the polygraph. It's inherent. We can't require it already. If we're allowed to ask, and as is noted, it does sometimes happen, that is where it becomes problematic. The fact is that during the process of sexual assault investigation, the sexual assault reporting, although the bill as it's proposed has provisions in there requiring consent, informed consent, and how it can be used, and I think it indicates in there that polygraph information cannot be used, is not admissible in court. There's a reason for it. It's not reliable. It's never been able to be used in court. It is not inconsistent, and I think in terms of what the legislature has done before, there was a time that police officers were subject to polygraph examination. And there was a law in the books that said I, as a police chief, could ask, require a police officer undergo a polygraph examination under certain circumstances, and it's been over 35 years since that's been law. Because the legislature at that time recognized that we're not dealing with a criminal suspect here. Can't require a police officer to undergo a polygraph examination. As a matter of fact, when that law was amended, you can't require an employee to undergo a polygraph examination. You can't ask or require an employee to undergo a polygraph examination. I cannot believe that the legislature would think that crime victims, and specifically sexual assault victims, would be given less of consideration than every other employee in the state of Minnesota. This has a very chilling effect on reporting. It has a very chilling effect on the investigation and certainly the viability of that investigation. And if, in fact, we allow this to be part of that process, it is absolutely inevitable that the willingness or unwillingness to take a polygraph examination will be the sole determining factor in the guilt or innocence or the rest of the prosecution phase of that, because that's simply the mindset that we're certainly not immune to as officers, but the public perception is if they're willing to take a polygraph, if they're not willing to take a polygraph, regardless of the reliability of the polygraph, that's what determines the viability of the case, and that just does not represent fact. That's just not reality. So I would ask and strongly urge that you adopt the language as it's written. Do not ask, do not require, as we don't for any other crime victims, do not ask, do not require that victims of sexual assault take a polygraph examination. It's just bad business.
Thank you, Chief Peterson. Are there any questions of the committee for the testifier for Chief Peterson? Okay. Seeing none, then, were there any, was there any testimony in opposition to this bill in the room? Anyone from the public who wishes to be heard on House File 1354? Seeing none, then Representative Paymar re-renews his motion. Can you re-renew? Renew, whatever the case. And you're an ex officio member, is that correct, Representative Paymar? So you can still move but not vote? Is that the story?
I believe so.
Okay, I can't remember these things. Whatever the case, all in favor of said motion to be re-referred to public safety policy, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Okay. Representative Olin, we have file House File 506.
Mr. Chairman, committee, basically what 506 does is it corrects a gap in the presently existing statutes. Domestic abuse no contact orders.
You know what, I apologize, Ms. Representative Olin. Could you go ahead and move your bill first?
I'm sorry about that. I'll move the bill since I am on this committee. So.
Thank you very much. You've moved the bill. The bill's before us. Go ahead and proceed. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. I should have done that in the first place. I was thinking of it earlier and then forgot.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, this bill is basically brought here to cover a gap in the system as we presently have it. And I'll go through the bill in a second, but let me explain what the gap is. The gap is basically in the order for protection statutes that now exist, third-time offenders would become a felony. That's not what we're dealing with here. But the domestic abuse order, no or no contact orders never reached the stage of a felony and never had any required jail time or any penalty, specific provisions for penalties. So what we had is a situation, as I would define it, is the young lady and quite often my crime victim advocate in my own office has had to run between to make sure there is an OFP order and a domestic abuse no contact order in order to ensure that they could get the toughest penalties available. With that background, let me just run through the bill quickly. What this bill would do is on the bottom of the first page, it would make it a gross, if it's a gross misdemeanor conviction, which presently does exist, you'd require a minimum 10 days in jail. So there would actually be, plus some other provisions, of course, that wouldn't be the only thing that happened to him because it'd be subject to all sorts of other provisions. If you were to get to a third year offense within 10 years, it'd turn into a felony. And at that stage, you'd be subject to other more direct provisions, and you'd have, of course, a felony on your record. I'm not going to go, but the provisions require a minimum of 30-day period of incarceration, plus counseling and some other appropriate things on probation if you should get a stay of imposition or execution of your sentence. So basically, it toughens up and gives you a direct sentence. The last thing the provisions do is under the qualified domestic violence related offenses, as is the case in some other offenses, it would list the murder in first degree murder and second degree murder or attempts as qualified offenses, which unfortunately the way the statutes read now does not happen, which doesn't make any sense at all. I have with me Assistant Attorney General David Voigt to explain it further.
Go ahead, Mr. Boyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As was indicated, this legislation closes a hole in the Domestic Abuse Act that essentially allows violations of no contact orders to be treated less seriously than domestic abuse orders for protection. The Domestic Abuse Act provides those two court orders to protect the abuse victim. And for the order for protection, the abuse victim or perhaps a family member needs to take the initiative to make a petition to the court and perhaps go through a court hearing in order to get that order. The no contact order is an order that's put into place after the abuser has been charged with an offense, and it allows the judge to put the no contact order in effect without the victim having to go through that process. Now, for the domestic abuse victim, often the most vulnerable and volatile time is after the abuser has been arrested and charged with an offense and then released from jail, either on bail or otherwise. And that's where the no contact order provides protection to the abuse victim. It doesn't make sense for the law to treat a violation during that time period less seriously than it treats a violation of the domestic abuse order for protection. And it also doesn't make sense to require the victim in a case where there's been an offense charged and a judge has ordered no contact to then have to go through the process of petitioning the court for an order for protection in order to receive the same protection of the law. Domestic violence is an important priority for Attorney General Lori Swanson. We have met with the Battered Women's Coalition, who is in support of this legislation. It closes a hole or a gap that currently exists in the Domestic Abuse Act, and the Attorney General urges passage of this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Representative Olin?
Just in closing, there are, of course, people from the violence groups in the audience, but I'm not going to call them as witnesses. I'm sure they're very supportive of this idea.
Are there any questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you have the opportunity or someone to get a fiscal note by any chance to get some sense of?
Actually, I have to plead guilty. I forgot to.
Okay.
I'll let Judge Gomez explain.
Sure.
Oh, you haven't? I haven't seen it.
Excellent.
I haven't seen it.
I think it looks like very good legislation. I'm just curious as to the impact on local facilities, county facilities.
I do have the fiscal note here, and I'm quickly trying to find the bottom line. But what I could say is we can make copies of it for everybody to be available, and that's
you can show it to me later. That'd be fine.
Okay.
And this is going being re-referred, obviously, to public safety and civil justice as well. So, are there any other questions? Seeing none, were there any other individuals from the public who wish to be heard on House File 506?
Yeah, I will make one comment quickly. I overlooked the thing. It says the creation of a felony level violation of domestic abuse, no contact order is projected to have a minimal impact on prison resources.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Olin. That being said, hearing nothing else, Representative Olin re-renews his motion for House File 506 to pass and be re-referred to Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Olin. Representative Cornish. Representative Paymar.
Sure, there's a bit of a mistake here on it, and there should be House File 1956 that is Representative Cornish's that had my name on it. That's one bill that we would like to, Representative Cornish will be presenting, and then House File 1858, Representative Cornish will be presenting on.
Okay, so just so I'm clear, Representative Paymar, we'll be hearing 1859 and
1858 and 1956, which you may not have in your possession. I'm not sure why, but both of these are related.
Okay, well, Representative Paymar, do I have it?
You probably don't have 1956.
Okay, yeah, do we have copies of it? Okay, the page has copies of it. We'll get those passed out. So let's...
Sorry for the confusion. My name was on it. It was supposed to be Representative Cornish.
I see. Okay. So I guess what we'll do, Representative Paymar, is here 1858 first, and by that time that's done, we'll get 1956 passed around. Does that sound good?
Thank you.
Okay, good. Representative Cornish, thank you for coming.
Mr. Chairman and members, I have House File 1858, and not only do I have a cold, I've developed a fever on the way in here, so I won't do much of the talking. I'll let the testifiers do most of it. I'll have a couple of amendments here to get into the shape I'd like it to, and then also a small oral amendment. If I could pass these amendments out, it'll be the A07-0302 amendment and the A1 amendment. Before I get into the bill, you want me to just put the amendments to get in the shape I wanted?
You could, but we could, if we could get those passed out just so we can see Representative Cornish. Are you able to explain these amendments while they're being passed out?
Well, it's hard to do in with this...
they're going to be
basically the
thank you. Oh, it looks like we have them all now, Representative Cornish.
Okay. I guess I should get somebody to move the bill for me.
Oh, that's correct. Well, you can move the bill, Representative Cornish. I think you're on the committee, right?
Okay.
So go ahead and move it if you'd like, and we'll you can be heard on the bill.
I think we're going to the joint committee with it this afternoon. Then?
It's going to be, the motion is to pass and be re-referred to Public Safety and Civil Justice, which is one of the committees in the joint committee. So,
Mr. Chairman, members, House File 1858 that we're moving as relates to no contact orders and domestic abuse. It involves training for police officers and awareness, some standards to be developed and some free service development of courses but a post board and training to be giving to statewide to peace officers. And just a short presentation of why this is so important. In recent cases that have developed that our witnesses will testify concerning. Ms. Scarlett Falucci is here with me, and another testifier that she'll introduce and talk about the importance of the police and training and coordination along with the domestic violence advocacy groups and the standards that are coming in and the training that'll help situations not develop like they have in the past and get the right information to the officers at the right time and everybody being on the same sheet of music. Okay, Mr. Chairman, would you like to introduce the amendments now? Or?
Yes, if we could speak to the amendments. Just to clarify, Representative Cornish, do any of these amendments have anything to do with training for police officers who have things thrown at them in committee?
No, I got that pretty long time before.
I just wasn't sure if I could add it in at the last minute or anything. Okay, go ahead on those amendments.
Mr. Chairman, the first, I guess, in the small oral amendment on the main bill on House File 1858 on line 1.14, after orders, make a period and then delete the rest of that sentence.
And what does that do then, Representative Cornish?
What that does is get rid of some language that was problematic with peace officers and myself concerning the attempt to increase peace officer empathy. I guess the thought was that police officers already had empathy as far as continuing training and awareness we could all use, but the empathy made it look like they were lacking in that, and it was just, it didn't look a little out of place.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
And now, then,
go ahead.
The A1 amendment, the offer of that, it's kind of self-explanatory. On page 1, line 9, delete, develop, and insert, revise, and update. And before in-service, insert development. Or, excuse me, develop. I believe this came from the post board, and it's talking about whether or not they already have the basic framework and infrastructure developed, a number of objectives out there, but they want to revise and update those. Page 1, line 10, after cases, it says to insert domestic violence dynamics and assessment of the dangers posed by offenders, just giving the post board some more direction in what this is supposed to entail, the training.
Okay. Then I would, as in terms of these, I guess what we would have you do is move the A1 amendment, unless there are any questions. Anyone have any questions about the A1 amendments? Hearing none. All in favor of the A1, I can do these both together, can I, Chair, if I am right? And both these amendments, all in favor of both these amendments to be put into House File 1858, to put it in the shape that the author would like. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion passes. It is in the order, so Representative Cornish to the bill as amended.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, what I'd like to do is introduce Carla Ferrucci and let her take it from here with some remarks and introduce my other witness eventually. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Mr. Ferrucci.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carla Ferrucci, and I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Coalition for Bettered Women. And I'm just here because I think that there's going to be some confusion, and I'm here to clarify any questions and support Vicki Seliger-Swenson, who some of you had heard from before, who's here to talk about the importance of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Ferrucci. Is Vicki here? Oh, yeah.
Yep, she's here.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Seliger-Swenson, and thank you for allowing me to be here to testify this morning. I'm here to tell the story of my sister, Terry Lee, and how it pertains to the proposed House files. My sister, Terry Lee, was the 17th woman murdered in Minnesota by an intimate partner in 2006, and also killed that fatal morning was Timothy Hawkinson, Sr. Am I too loud? used to kiss the mic, who did everything to protect her. But I want to tell you briefly who she was. A loving mother, daughter, sister, and friend. She was happily married to a man named Ty Lee, who she had known since seventh grade. And when he died in a car accident in 2001, she was left to raise four small children, ages 1, 3, 5, and 7, by herself. And with the love and support of her parents and her family and friends, she rallied around those four kids and did a tremendous job. Nearly 2 years later, she began dating a man she had met while working at 3M. He was a trusted colleague, a 25-year employee with no criminal history. They shared a few mutual friends, and he seemed safe. They dated for nearly 2 years when she ended the relationship for good, but he was relentless about being with her, to the point where on July 29, 2006, he broke into her home and attacked her with butcher knives. Also found in his car, he was a chemist at 3M, was enough explosives to burn down her home. He fled when Terry's neighbor saw his car and dialed 911. He was later arrested at his father's home in Wisconsin and charged with second-degree assault, burglary, and making terroristic threats. But from that point on, this was not a relationship of years of endured abuse. That was the first time that he physically tried to harm her. But from that moment on, she followed the system. She did all of the right things and trying to protect herself. She gave statements to police. She pressed charges. She went to court, and she testified. And in fact, her documented words in Washington County Court states that, "I have no doubt in my mind he will return to my home to kill me." 2 days later, he was released after posting the 10% required bond, totaling $7,500. One of the conditions of his release was to have no contact with Terry, her family, or her residents. Yet he violated that no-contact order multiple times. He tried contacting her through friends, and there was an email sent from his father's computer asking her to meet with him. Without responding to that email, she called 3M Police, which they also advised her to turn it over to Maplewood Police. Maplewood Police came and told her, because her no-contact order, the handwritten part said no contact. It didn't specify no contact, no indirect or direct. There was no arrest made. And at that point, Terry had to engage in the game of he said, she said, and had to explain how the judge told both of them in court that it was no indirect or direct contact. As I said, there was no arrest made. The officer explained to her that he lived in Wisconsin, so that they couldn't cross the state line, which is not true. And then the officer explained to her that that was just his way of trying to get back together with her. My sister responded to the officer, "No, he wants me dead." He also violated the no-contact order when he showed up at Terry's daughter's volleyball match at an away junior high. Her daughter came off the court crying to her coach that that man was not allowed to be near her and that he had tried to kill her mother. Her coach brought her to the principal's office and tried calling Terry at work, calling her at home, and then calling her on her cell phone. Meanwhile, he fled back to Wisconsin. I do believe the school officials acted the best that they could with the limited information that they had. What they needed was a no-contact order with a picture on it so that they could have identified him and called 911 immediately rather than trying to contact Terry. Police were finally called and arrived. My niece identified him. They had him on school surveillance camera, and witnesses gave statements. But again, there was no arrest. Later that night, I had my final conversation with my sister, which lasted about 45 minutes. And as a teacher and a coach, I wanted to know exactly what her next steps were, because I felt if this coach had better information, she could have acted more quickly. Terry explained to me that in addition to calling police the next day, which she did because they've admitted to receiving her calls, begging them to arrest him, she tried desperately to obtain a picture of him, and 3M wouldn't release it, data privacy, understandable. She spent hours looking for rolls of film to take to Target, which she did, and still came up empty-handed. What she did not know is that because there was a booking, the mugshot was public information, and I believe if that were attached, it would have made a huge difference. She called later that day and left a message that she came up empty-handed. Still, no arrest was made, and less than 2 days later, our biggest became a reality when her ex-boyfriend broke into her home and shot Tim 3 times and Terry 6, killing them both. Her 2 young daughters ran to the neighbor's house for help, while her 2 boys hid in their closet before being rescued by members of the SWAT team nearly 2 hours later. As you can understand, this is very difficult to comprehend how this happened and how he violated the no-contact order multiple times with no arrests being made. I'm here today because I believe in every tragedy you can create hope, and I believe that the proposed house files would help save lives. It's too late for my sister, but I know that it would help protect women and all of us because we're all affected by domestic violence. There has been a lot of local and national interest in Terry's story. In fact, it's on the front page of the St. Paul Pioneer Press today. And I have asked repeatedly to local and national media, why are you so interested? So many women are murdered. Why my sister? And the common response is because she did all the right things. She took the steps we asked women to take, and she's dead. I believe we have an opportunity to look at the system more closely and make the necessary changes. The emotional part is obvious, even if it saves one life. And from a financial standpoint, sitting in criminal court yesterday and listening to the judge urge us to resolve this before it goes to trial, I know that I'm confident the money appropriated to this to these files would be a lot less cheaper than prosecuting a murder. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Swenson. Ms. Ferrucci, did you have further testifiers?
No, nope.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Were there questions of members of the committee for any of the testifiers? Okay. Seeing none then, was there any other testimony in the room, either for or against House File 1858? Seeing none then, Representative Cornish would renew his motion to pass. Yes,
Mr. Chair. Got one more amendment to make. Mr. Chairman, when I made the other amendment, there was a grammatical change that should have been made above it. I've got from counsel, I'd say, page 1, line 13, after the comma, insert and.
Okay, could you say that again, Representative Cornish?
On line 113, after the comma, insert and.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. All in.
Just wanted to thank Representative Paymar for bringing this to me and his help and counsel on it.
Thank you. All in favor of stated amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Then we do have the bill before us and the motion renewed is to pass as amended on those 3 amendments and referred to public safety and civil law. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. The bill is re-referred. And Representative Cornish, if we could, Representative Hillstrom is on kind of a time crunch of her committee. Could we sneak her in between you? That would be very helpful. Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, we have before us House File 1220. Can I have a motion from the committee to move the bill?
I'll make that motion.
Wonderful. Representative Holland moves House File 1220. We have it before us. The motion is to be re-referred to Public Safety and Civil Justice. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is related to child advocacy centers, and it is a grant for child advocacy centers that perform certain core functions. It's an appropriation of $1 million in fiscal year 08 and $1 million in fiscal year 09. With me is Caroline Lovett to speak to the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Lovett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Children's advocacy centers are really a model that's based on a team, in which that team, the primary focus is on the child victim and the families. And the community then needs to work together in a coordinated community response so that the victim and the quality of the services are all ensured. Children's advocacy centers are part of a National Children's Alliance that has set standards for accreditation, and those members then get site visited by a committee to make sure that those standards are set and to ensure the quality done by Children's advocacy centers throughout the country. There are about 400 accredited members of the National Children's Alliance throughout the United States, and another approximately 300 members of associate members who are not yet accredited. What I want to talk a little bit about what the accreditation does. It allows for improvement in the forensic interviews that are done so that if a child, a very young child, has been abused, the law enforcement agent does not interview the child. The child is interviewed by a trained interviewer who's got skills in child development, who recognizes the importance of not including the answer in the question. And that's very different from the way that most people will talk to little children particularly. It's very easy to say, you've got an owie here, it hurts here, doesn't it? Can you tell us how that happened? Where in fact, when you're interviewing a child who might have been abused, you want to be able to make sure that there are no leading questions, nothing that would lead the child to an answer that would not be accurate, because we feel that it's so important. So these standards, which are set and accredited by the National Children's Alliance, are followed by the Children's Advocacy Centers throughout the United States. Minnesota has really been a pioneering state for the development of Children's Advocacy Centers. We have three fully accredited members. The Midwest Children's Resource Center, of which I am the director, I'm Dr. Carolyn Levitt, and I've been that founding director. We were established in 1986, and we're centered at Children's Hospital of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And also a very pioneering member was the Corner House in Minneapolis. They were established in 1989. First Witness in Duluth has also been a longstanding member since the mid-90s. In addition to that, there is a new member in Bemidji, Minnesota, at the Family Advocacy Center in northern Minnesota, at the Bemidji Hospital. There's a new developing center in Winona, Minnesota called Maddie's Place. There's also a new one developing at the Mayo Center, the Family Advocacy Center in Rochester. So we come as a state chapter to really ensure that there is quality of work, that we can improve the services that are put forth to child and victims of physical and sexual abuse. And I think the important thing is that we are able to recognize then, particularly which children need trauma-focused therapy, which children will go on to have post-traumatic stress, will be hampered in their life goals as other children who have not been abused would not have been. And we've also felt that prevention is extremely important to recognize because of these abusive experiences in their young childhood. Many of those children will go on to have chronic illness, chronic mental health illness, but even more than that, the CDC has recognized for the first time what a huge impact child abuse has had on the health, just the health of our citizens, such that $24 billion a year are spent on health costs related. So a huge prevention, not to mention the huge cost of the criminal part of it, having criminals that you're much more familiar with. I think with that, we also have another witness. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Levin.
All right. Mr. Chair, also is a client. I think it's Kayla, and I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce her last name, if she could come to the table. But in addition, while she's coming up, I wanted to state that the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota, and Sexual Abuse Prevention Network all support this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And Kayla, whose name we will shortly hear.
Yeah. Hello. I'm Kayla Bjorkam, and I would like to share with you my experience at First Witness. In 2001, I confided in my grandmother that I was being sexually abused by my grandfather. And it was a very difficult thing. I was young. I was 11 years old. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I knew what was happening was wrong. And so that's when I came forward about it. And we told my mom, and the police got involved, and I was told that the police were going to be picking me up from school. And when you're a young child and you think police officers, well, they it's like cops and robbers. They get the bad guys. And when the police came to pick me up, I started to feel like I had done something wrong. And I was scared. I was terrified. I wanted to take it all back. I wanted to just say, nope, it didn't happen. Sorry, I lied. I didn't want to go through with it. My family was changing. Things were happening the police. I mean, just seeing everybody's reactions, it was really hard to realize that what I did was a good thing when all these bad things were going on. And then we pulled into the First Witness Center, and it was like a house. It looked like a house with a parking lot. We walked in, we walked up to the house and rang a doorbell, and they came and let us in. And when you walk in, it was like an office, but like a house, and there was a living room and other rooms, and they were extremely nice, and they made me feel really comfortable, which was what I needed, seeming I had just gotten pulled out of school by police officers. And I guess we went through the interview, and the interview could have been a lot worse, I think, than what it was. It was easier than I thought it would be. He helped me a lot with the wording, and like instead of having to come out right and say it, he helped push it along, I guess, and that was a lot easier to get through the interview quickly and efficiently, and it definitely helped. And then afterwards, the counseling there was great, because I definitely needed it. I still felt like I did something wrong. And I honestly think that if I would have been taken to a police station, I would have said no, it didn't happen. I would have taken it all back. These centers are needed more than I think some people realize, because a lot of kids, they take it back. They say, oh, no, I lied, I'm sorry, because they're scared. It's a really scary thing to have to go through. And I think having the counseling and having them put us kids on the right path is a good thing, because we do grow up and we become adults, and if you take care of us while we're young, it helps develop us to be better people when we're older. And I think that's the world needs to be a definitely a better place. So if you can help us when we're younger and help us deal with these problems, it limits a lot of the crime and other criminal acts that are happening. So I think having trained professionals in the right facilities, it gets things done a lot faster, easier, and definitely mentally better for everyone. Thank you for letting me speak to you today.
Thank you, Ms. Bjorthompton, for your testimony. And speaking also as a prosecutor, I've had experience with having child witnesses on the stand, and there's no question there's a need for it, and it's very helpful for myself as a person who's trained in the profession but not trained with very key, important factors like what you went through. So thank you very much. It makes a big difference. Are there any questions of members for the witnesses or for Representative Hillstrom?
Also, I would like to say that I went through the counseling for 6 months, or about 6 months, but I mean, even today, I can still go back to the center and get help if I needed it, and I think that's also helpful too. It's been 6 years, and if something stirs up bad things, it's they're still there. I think that's good too, knowing that they're going to be around as long as I need them.
Thank you. There being nothing else, who moved the bill? Oh, is Representative Allred?
I'll renew the motion.
Renews the motion to have this pass and be referred to Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And is Representative Cornish up there still? Oh, there he is, back in. Good. Right on. Come on. Okay. Thank you. Now, Representative Cornish, I have 1859, which looks to be very different from 1956. Is 1956 your bill, but it shouldn't have Representative Paymar's name on it? Is that?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Paymar.
I'm sorry for the confusion here. We are going to amend House File 1859. And not deal with 1956, given that there were some problems. And Representative Cornish can explain the.
Okay.
Sorry for the confusion.
Why don't you
there
go
were
ahead
three
and
bills, and now there's two.
Okay. Representative Cornish, why don't you go ahead and explain what we're going to do to House File 1859?
Mr. Chairman, members, what we're going to do with House File 1859 is amend it with a delete all and forget about the other bill that we had up.
And what this concerns is a photograph on a no-contact order. And it started out originally to kind of mandate that they get together and make out a form and put a picture on it. But we ran into some problems with coordination between the groups involved, responsibility, and thought it would be too much to do without getting together first and talking it over and coordinating how they were going to do it. And so what this delete all would do is the state court administrator will convene a multidisciplinary implementation work group to study the attachment of the photographs to the no contact order and report back, as you notice in the delete all. I think the previous testifier, Vicki, has stated that if there would have been a picture of the no contact order, she thinks the whole thing could have been avoided, the tragedy. And so with that, I would offer the move 1859 and offer the delete all amendment AO703852.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Moves the AO703852 amendment as a delete all to put it in shape that the author would like. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. We do have the delete all in front of us. Was there anything else you wanted to say on it, Representative Cornish?
We'll do it.
Okay. Great. Were there any other testifiers in the audience to speak to this delete all? Seeing none, then Representative Cornish renews his motion to pass House File 1859 as amended by the delete all and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. That appears to be the last bill we have before us. Was there anything else we had before the committee that I'm missing?
Did you do your own thing?
No, we did cram this bill. Okay, so therefore, committee is adjourned.